Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm your host Dave Marshall, and this is episode 115B on the diatoms of Lake Baikal. If you've not yet listened to the first part, then what are you doing here? Go and listen to that first. But if you're returning, then welcome back. In this second part, our guest, Professor Anson Mackay, walks us through how he was able to determine the paleoproductivity of the lake over the last tens of thousands of years. We then look at how the changes in that productivity can tell us about the world at that time, but how we can also use that information to understand how the lake is reacting to human activities, and then what we can expect in respect to climate change in the future. As always, you can find images that accompany this episode on our website, and we're always keen to encourage discussion on our social media channels. We're now very close to 6,000 followers on Twitter, so if you're not already following us at PaleoCast, that is your homework for this episode. Thanks to everyone for all of the donations that we've had recently. Those of you who contribute monthly, you keep the show going, and we've also been able to save up enough of that money for a couple of new microphones for the team, so expect a nice step up in audio quality in the next couple of months or so. You'll be hearing many more voices on the show, and lots of different kinds of discussions, so subscribe wherever you can so that you don't miss out. I hope you enjoy this episode. Okay, so let's finally focus on Lake Baikal and do a little case study. So a lot of your work has focused on it. You've told us that it's an ancient lake, the deepest in the world, and it's in Siberia. Is there anything else we need to know about it?
Lake Baikal is truly one of the world's most amazing ecosystems for scientific study in the world today, not just as an incredible lake, but just one of the world's most important ecosystems. It's host to many superlatives. It's the deepest lake in the world. It's the oldest lake in the world, with sediment formation going back 25, 30 million years. And that kind of sort of, means that we can compare it to these long marine records. Because of its great depth as well, it contains 1/5 of the world's surface fresh water that's not frozen up in the ice caps or glaciers. So this one lake contains 20% of the world's fresh water, which is, in terms of quantity, is absolutely amazing. And so because it's got this very long geological history, it's a very it's got lots of different habitats within the lake itself. The species there have evolved over a long period of time, and so it's got a very high level of what we call endemicity. And this means the number of species that are found just in one place and nowhere else. And about 75% of Lake Baikal's plants and animals are only found there and nowhere else in the world, which means, in terms of biodiversity, it's a highly important site.
And so what?
Sorry, I was going to say. So it's such an important ecosystem that in 1996 the United Nations declared it a World Heritage Site. For being one of, for its uniqueness, and so in that respect, again, it's globally, it's an important ecosystem, not just for freshwater.
So, can you describe your study? Which hypotheses were you looking to test?
So I've probably show my age a wee bit. So I've been working on Lake Baikal now since 1992. So that's like almost 30 years. And to work in one lake, and I think that just kind of exemplifies how interesting a lake it is. because there are always new questions to ask of it, and it always, every time you sort of answer, you think you've answered one question, it, you know, new ones are always thrown up. And what's kind of really interesting for me working on this one ecosystem for so long is that we've been able to address hypotheses in Lake Baikal that have really kind of, they've also been very timely in terms of the global environmental concerns that have been going on, you know, at that particular time. So when I first started to work on Lake Baikal in the early 1990s, it was a time when we were very interested in looking at the degradation of fresh water, especially through human contamination from the burning of fossil fuels. It's essentially kind of sort of acid rain. And in the 1980s, so Lake Baikal is another reason why it's unique. It contains the world's only truly freshwater seal. And, you know, we think of seals as, you know, occurring, you know, in coastal areas and, you know, and in the oceans. But, you know, and Lake Baikal is inland, is the most continental inland place there is. But we have the seal that lives there, and the seals arrived there about 400,000 years ago and have evolved to be in Lake Baikal specifically. But then in the late 1980s, the seals were dying out in their thousands, and it was thought at the time that this is due to environmental degradation from pollution going into the lake. And so my project there was to go for the first time to look at diatoms, to see whether diatoms are changing in the last 100 years or so. And if you did see changes in the last 100 years or so in the diatoms, could that be linked to the pollution, maybe even acid rain or something? And so this was kind of the you know, when we're talking about Lake Baikal, the last 100 years in this lake are preserved in the top maybe like 4 to 5 centimeters of sediment. And given that the lake is like sort of 1400 to 1600 meters deep, how on earth do you collect the top centimeters of sediment? You know, it's, you know, we when we went out there, we were told this is impossible. You can't do it. And people were only using Lake Baikal to reconstruct sort of glacial interglacial cycles going back over hundreds of thousands of years. And this is one of the great challenges was working with Russian collaborators who knew the importance of Lake Baikal and the need to preserve it. But then how do we look at the history of the environment there over recent timescales? So we even developed new types of corridors to go out there to collect just as very surface sediments. So we designed those in London and we applied them in Lake Baikal with some Russian technological help as well. So what my postdoc research there, but looking at the diatoms, it showed that when we reconstructed the pollution history of the lake over the last kind of 100 years, we found that the lakes did have evidence of pollution, but it was kind of more similar to sort of background sort of levels that we might find in the Arctic, for example. And we found that the diatoms hadn't been responding to when the pollution increased. We found no response of the diatoms across the majority of the lake. But what we did find was that if we went back 150, 200 years ago, we saw major changes in the diatom flora happening between different species. And these species were in endemic to the lake. And that, because they happened in the south of the lake and also in the north of the lake, and the lake spans about 600 odd kilometers or so, that meant we had to have a much bigger driver causing those changes back through time. And we ascribe that to changes in climate linked to sort of the very cold little ice age about 400 years ago, going out into general global warming 150 years ago. And that is kind of sort of natural global warming linked to natural variation in their systems and stuff. So that was kind of our first big hypothesis, of the lake being polluted. Yes, but not much. The diatoms weren't responding to pollution, but they were responding to a natural climate change. So that was super interesting at the time.
That's amazing that you can track like the effects that climate change have on a species just by this proxy of looking at diatoms.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so when we were doing it, I was, going out, we had a ship in the summertime, going out, taking cores, and also we worked from the ice as well. And somewhere that's this brilliant subject, Lake Baikal, is that it freezes over every year. and we get about up to a meter of ice that spans the whole of the lake. And so while it's very cold, you know, we were working in temperature about -30°C. So literally you drill your hole in the ice with pickaxes, you would drop your coder down, you bring it back up, and within seconds it would freeze. So one of the challenges was to try to work in these kind of sub-zero temperatures. But we were collecting our lake sediment records, and we were slicing the sediment at 1 to 2 millimeter intervals, which is incredibly high resolution. And that was how we could really tell when we had these changes occurring linked to that recent sort of climate variability. And we're seeing, and you know, we'll talk about this in a bit later on, but you know, we've actually gone back there 20 years later, and we've tried to core some of the same sites. Can we see evidence of anthropogenic global warming? And I guess I'll talk a bit about that in a wee bit.
So with your most recent work, which kind of questions have you been looking to answer?
So, you know, science is always incremental. And so much of our recent work on Lake Baikal has been building on not just previous work that we've done there, but also trying to address some of the important questions of the day, really. And in my mind, these are linked to both biodiversity change, but also to still climate change as well. And a bit perversely, we're now looking at increases in human impact through nutrient enrichment again, just in the last like 10 years. That is again sort of hitting headlines. And lots of the work that we're doing out on Lake Baikal now are addressing each of those three key areas. And these three key areas, they're not separate. They're all kind of interconnected, and is kind of understanding how they interconnect is also really important, which is why just focusing in on one place such as Lake Baikal, we can start to untangle some of those interactions. So from the early work that we did, when we sort of deciphered that pollution was not affecting Lake Baikal, maybe there was some evidence in very localized coastal regions, but you know, that was maybe sort of which can become important later on in our story. But we did sort of determine that we think that climate change was actually important at quite a fine resolution and in quite recent times. And so that allowed us to look at Lake Baikal records in the past, you know, the last interglacial 125,000 years ago, to look at how when the lake was warmer and wetter than it is today. You know, can we use that as a prediction how Lake Baikal might change in the future, when the world becomes warmer and wetter, in no doubt, and you know, in another kind of 100 years, so we can use the past as an analog as to what might happen in the future. But even more recently than that, so we were thinking about, okay, so if we've got sort of rapid global warming at the moment, and that's as a form of abrupt climate change, can we use the Lake Baikal record to reconstruct about abrupt climate change, you know, in the relatively recent past, you know, maybe over the last kind of 10 to 12,000 years, and so for that we obtained. I've been part of numerous expeditions to Lake Baikal, and one of those that's funded by the EU, we obtained lake sediment records that went back about 130,000 years. And we looked at some of those sediment records that especially had very high resolution going back over the last 15,000 years. And so from that, we were able to look at sediment environments that went from the late glacial up to the present day. And that included several well-known periods of abrupt climate change that were linked to rapid global warming in the past, but also rapid global cooling in the past. And we're looking at how diatoms responded to those abrupt periods of change. We could see how the diatom flora changed both in terms of biodiversity, but also how productivity in the lake changed as well, because we could use diatoms as indicators of paleoproductivity. So it's, again, these are kind of really sort of interesting questions we could ask from the lake in terms of an ecosystem function perspective, which I think is just inherently very interesting.
So you've got 15,000 years to look at. You've got sediments that record pretty much every single year. How did you count the diatoms in that? Did you have to count down, say, 13,000 layers to get to a specific bit that you wanted to count? And then how many diatoms did you have to count from that layer?
So, yeah, so again, interesting questions there. So one of the ways that makes Lake Baikal different from most other deep lakes, so even though it's 14 to 1600 meters depth of water, there's still oxygen at the bottom water surface sediment interface. And that's because we have this process called deep water renewal. And so the we also have oxygen going from the top of the lake down into the bottom. And that's important because that allows animals to live at the very bottom of Lake Baikal. And we have this like almost wholly endemic fauna that exists there, that exists nowhere else in the world. And that means that this fauna is gradually, you know, it's kind of munching the diatoms basically at the very bottom of the lake. So that means we've always got this what's called bioturbation. And that's like a process we need to take account of. And so in Lake Baikal, we don't have these annual layers of form. So we can't get this annual resolution. But we have been able to get a resolution of what we call a multi-decadal. So by looking at diatoms every 5 millimeters depth in the lake sediment, we can look at a resolution of diatom change at about every 20 to 30 years. And that is actually really high. And we look at this sort of resolution going back every 30 years, going back 16,000 years, that is a pretty phenomenal record of past environmental change. And when we think of, you know, sort of climate changes over periods of decades, so, you know, weather is what we have, you know, every year changing, you know, every you know, couple of years to 10 years. Climate is what we have over longer timescales, over decades, every 20, 30 years or so. Then Lake Baikal has a brilliant paleoclimate record for that. So that is, you know, one complication, but we can, that is fine for the hypothesis that we're testing. In terms of counting the diatoms, it's just very laborious. So I've had like sort of PhD students who've been counting diatoms. I've had postdoctoral scientists counting diatoms. I've had myself cutting, I still count my own diatoms on Lake Baikal as well. So we've had like teams of people who've been doing all this counting for quite a few decades now.
Yeah, I've just got my calculator up on the screen here.
Oh, yes.
16,000 years, on average, say maybe you take a sample every 30 years, that's still over 500 samples. And then times that by the number of diatoms that you get in each, are you looking at, say, maybe 200, 300?
Yeah, oh no, so in terms of our diatom counting, so we would count between 300 and 600 of these shells in every slide. So we're looking at hundreds of thousands of, you know, counts that we have just for this one record, maybe even going to the millions when we take all our records together. So, you know, it's a phenomenal amount of information. And you know, we've taken them from multiple locations in Lake Baikal because it's so large. You know, we can't rely on one site to tell the whole story. But you know, the most recent stuff that we have coming out is based on, you know, a few locations in the south of Lake Baikal. We've still to publish a lot of our information on long timescales from the north of Lake Baikal, just because there's so much information there. It takes so long to assemble the data that, you know, it is kind of a lifetime work in some ways, which is again why I've been working there for such a long period of time, approaching 30 years. So yeah, it's a lot of work, but interesting work.
Yes, huge shout out to your students.
Students, postdocs, absolutely. Well, you know, these things are always collaborations, so yeah.
Okay, so we're looking at all the different diatoms. We've got all the different diatom species. What does each one of the different species tell you about the paleoproductivity at the time? Will the presence of species A tell you something different, or is it more an assemblage that you get like A, F, and M together?
Yeah. So the way that we do it in Baikal is that, you know, we can look at sort of total productivity, pillar productivity in the lake, and we do that through two different means, actually three different ways in Baikal. We can look at it by just looking at diatoms as a mass of biogenic silica, and that will tell us that gives us some indication about pillar productivity. We can look at diatoms as individual species and how they change through time. And one way we can do that is by looking at the biovolume of a diatom. And the biovolume is really just it's the size of a diatom, it's the three-dimensional size of a diatom. And so because diatoms are, you know, they're living organisms, they contain carbon, they contain silica. The larger a species, the more carbon it contains. And if it contains more carbon, then it's going to have a greater importance for pillar productivity, because primary production is based on carbon, of course. And so we're looking at not just the species of diatoms, but we can look at their shape and their size and see how that has developed through time. And by looking at their shape and the size and putting the shapes and sizes from different species together, we can reconstruct then pillar productivity in terms of biovolumes. So there are a number of different approaches that we can do this. And finally, we've been looking at now, cutting edge work, and we've been looking at the silicon isotope composition of the diatom shells themselves to try to reconstruct pillar productivity, especially over recent timescales of the last couple of thousand years. So again, there are a number of different approaches to try and do this, and we've been utilizing all of these on Lake Baikal sediments.
So now we've got a really incredibly high resolution picture of paleo productivity over the last 16,000 years. What have you learned from that? Is it linked to anything?
Yeah, so there are some things I think that we can certainly answer, and that is that when we look at how diatoms have changed over periods of decades with abrupt climate change, say abrupt cooling or abrupt warming, is that Lake Baikal responds, you know, almost instantaneously to global events. And so although Lake Baikal contains, like, you know, it's this massive volume of water, and it's, you know, it's in the continental interior of Central Asia, it still responds very sensitively to changes that are happening, say, in North Atlantic circulation through time. And so in that sense, you know, we've known for a long time the Lake Baikal is integrated into the global climate cycles. And what we're doing here is that we're showing that it's also integrated at during high resolution abrupt events, certainly over kind of more recent geological timescales. We've also started to show that in terms of biodiversity, that when we have abrupt periods of climate change, the productivity and biodiversity seem to be tightly coupled, but they're inverse to each other. So when we have greater productivity, the diatoms are less diverse, which means that when we have a few species are contributing mainly to pillar productivity over abrupt period of climate change. But when we look at something like the Holocene in the last 11,000 years, where we have the climate is, you know, relatively, it's more stable than it was before that at the end of the last ice age, then we see less connection between productivity and biodiversity. And that's intriguing as to, you know, why these different processes are happening between the ecosystem function of the lake and productivity and the actual species that are linking into that in terms of the diatoms. And, we don't have the answers yet. We're just seeing these patterns, we're seeing these patterns in the sedimentary record, and now we're trying to understand why that might be the case.
So some diatoms, for instance, might love the new conditions, and as you say, they contribute more to the biosilica total production. You're talking about an instantaneous change, and your resolution is over 30 years. You've also mentioned before that you've been studying diatoms in Lake Baikal since 1992, which was 28 years ago. So have you seen any difference in that time with all of the anthropogenic climate change? You're saying that the lake responds almost instantaneously. Have you seen yourself any difference in the the productivity of the lake in the time that you've been studying it?
Yeah, so what's been sort of really interesting, and I guess this was kind of sort of one thing kind of sort of pays off from working in an ecosystem for such a long period of time, is that I mentioned earlier that we kind of showed that Lake Baikal wasn't responding to the pollution coming from industry in the lake's catchment. But we did think we saw some very localized areas of perhaps contamination linked to nutrient enrichment. But you know, they were so localized, that wasn't our main kind of sort of finding from the research. However, since about the last kind of sort of 10-12 years or so, Russian colleagues have been documenting changes in the shores of Lake Baikal, have started to get more and more algal blooms in them, and they're finding increasing populations of this algae called Spirogyra, which can be dangerous because once if you get an algal bloom, and then when that starts to decompose, it sucks out all the oxygen, which means then other organisms find it much more difficult to survive. And so they've been trying to pinpoint, what was causing these algal blooms, and they think they've pinpointed it now to basically increasing tourism in the area. And we have increasing tourism since when the Soviet economy collapsed in the early 1990s, gradually has been building up again. But with that, with lots of increasing tourism, especially like from Southeast Asia, China tourists coming over, but the infrastructure is not kept up with this. And so basically in many parts of the coastline, you have lots of hotels that are building up, but sewage is going untreated into the lake. So we've been trying to go back to one of our original questions, and is, okay, so can we use the diatom record? Because we know that they respond very sensitively to changes in nutrients. Diatoms are very good for doing that. Can we see changes in the diatom record that we could also pinpoint to changes in this eutrophication that we're seeing in the coastal sediments? So we had a new project that we went out and we recored Lake Baikal from some of the same locations as we did in 1992 and 1993. So basically some 20 odd years later. And that was like really quite satisfying to do. And so from that, we have found some sort of really intriguing results. So the question as to whether the lake's current problems linked to nutrient enrichment, are those affecting the diatoms? We think that at least where we took our cores, which are from the deep part of the lake, that does not seem to be happening. So the recent nutrient problem in Lake Baikal, which is real, we're not seeing that happening in the deep part of the lake yet. And we think that is just because the impact is restricted to the coastal part. And whereas most of the water is in the deeper part, that has yet to be affected. However, what we are seeing in the lake is that we think we're seeing changes linked to global warming. And so some of the gradual changes that we sort of saw 20 odd years ago from my initial work, in some parts of the lake, these have become much more stronger in our more recent analysis. And especially what we've seen is a decline in these species of diatoms that are endemic, and they're very heavily silicified. So they have been declining in abundance, and what we've seen in their place is an increase in species that what we call cosmopolitan, that is found from many other lakes around the world, that are much more lightly silicified, and they're able to tolerate the warmer waters of Lake Baikal. So they seem to be doing better at the expense of these the cold water endemics. And so we're, you know, that is problematic, because although Lake Baikal's flora has changed in the past to do with global warming, and that's been natural, what we worry about now is that the impact of global warming on the lake's biology now, linked into the pollution of humans into the lake, those two interacting stressors, that's never happened before. And so the danger that we're worried about now is that if those two stressors interact, then that's going to make the problem affecting the biodiversity of the lake much more problematic.
I was going to ask about that and say, what can, if anything, can we predict from the lake based on what we know in the past? But yeah, that's a bit worrying if there's no precedent for it. But if we look at just global warming itself and think about just the temperature, if we are to have a couple of degrees increase as is predicted, do you have any idea of how the lake might react to that?
So I really don't know how exactly the lake will react in terms of the composition of the diatoms. We can make some hypotheses what might happen. So as the because Lake Baikal is frozen over, you know, between 4 to 7 months of the year, depending on where the lake you are. What we have shown in the lake is that over the last sort of 30, 40 years, the ice cover on the lake has been getting a shorter duration, and also the ice cover has been getting thinner as well. And that means that one of the unique features by many species in Lake Baikal is that they evolve to grow under the ice and when the ice breaks up. And so if the ice is present for a shorter period of time, we're going to have species that are more adapted to live in the lake that aren't so, that don't need the ice so much. So that we can be sure of. Also, because diatoms are heavily silicified, they sink out of the photic zone, where the light is. As lakes become warmer, the surface of the lake, it mixes less. And that means that we have less water being brought up from the colder, deeper parts into the warmer upper parts. And that means the diatoms are more likely to sink out. And that means that other algae, such as green algae, are more likely to sort of take their place, such as pico plankton and stuff. So we can predict what changes may happen. And we think that we're seeing some of those changes happening in the present day based on those predictions. And that's why some of our work, we've got sort of quite high confidence in it. But when we look further back in the past for potential analogs, one of the things about Baikal, which makes it like really unique as opposed to other lakes in the world, is because its sediments have never been glaciated. Okay, so you've got this long sedimentary environment. And when we look back over timescales of millions of years, we can see how diatoms have changed every glacial interglacial cycle for the Quaternary, going back 2.6 million years. We can see how diatoms have changed sort of during the Pliocene, when the world was in an almost ice-free state, and certainly much warmer and wetter than it is in the present day. And there we saw sort of different species of diatoms predominated during those times. And I think what we can say is that when we had something like the Pliocene 5 million years ago, species of diatoms persisted for a much longer period of time. But when we moved into Quaternary over glacial interglacial cycles every 100,000 years or so, we can almost track diatom evolution over these orbital timescales. It's really, really fascinating. And so I think what we can say is that the diatom floor in Lake Baikal, it's very dynamic. It has always been responding to climate change. So as the lake warms into the future, I've no doubt the diatoms will respond to that again. And we will see different species. We may even see evolution in action as species evolve to take account of a new Lake Baikal in a warmer world. How exactly that will manifest itself, I don't know. But we know from the past the lake is incredibly dynamic, and diatom evolution it's been part of the makeup of Lake Baikal. So I think that's quite fascinating.
So trying to extract any positives we can, we are seeing these diatoms come in and out of existence. Yeah. Every time a climatic event happens, something changes. Yeah. But the ecosystem always survives. The diatoms are still there. So how resilient is the ecosystem, and does it matter, say, if we lose those species endemic to Lake Baikal, we get these more cosmopolitan species coming in that are just in lakes all over the world? Does this really matter?
I think it does matter, because when we're thinking about a lake ecosystem and we think about the what we call these ecosystem services the lake provides in terms of sort of fish and protein or biodiversity value, carbon regulation, freshwater regulation, quality, etc. If we start having species that are coming in and displacing species that are living there already, then that means we're going to change the whole nature of, say, for example, the food web. And what we're already seeing in Lake Baikal, linked to the warming of the surface waters, is that we're seeing a mismatch now between when some species of the diatoms are blooming with the zooplankton that are eating them, and we're kind of seeing through long-term monitoring records, and there's some amazing monitoring records of the biological fauna and flora of Lake Baikal going back like 50, 60 years, done by Russian scientists, which is just incredible. And by using that information and tracing it to present day, we're seeing that now there's an increasing mismatch with some of the zooplankton and the diatom flora. We don't know what impact that's going to have on the lake ecosystem. But if you think about how the fish are tied into this, and then eventually the nerpa, this endemic seal, is also tied into this as well. What influence that will have on the food web in the future, we're kind of uncertain. So Lake Baikal is dynamic. Lake Baikal will survive global warming. It survived warmer periods in the past. It's just the lake ecosystem will change. Where there is a problem is when we're polluting the lake through nutrients and through sewage, etc. I think the positive to take home from this is that if we put in enough resources, we can combat that. We have enough examples of a good technological practice, good management practice, where we've managed to reduce nutrient inputs into lakes by having good wastewater treatment facilities, etc. And at the moment, those are just lacking on Lake Baikal for whatever reason. And if we can improve on that, then we will undoubtedly improve the ecological status of the lake, which means that we can still have tourism. We can still have people going to the lake and enjoying it. We just do it in a much more responsible fashion.
So your work on Lake Baikal is just one study, and there's so many other different lakes and different methodologies to use. Is a similar picture emerging from different lakes all over the world?
So there's been a number of probably to call sort of meta-analysis now, where people have kind of looked to different regional studies and they've kind of brought them together to get a more global picture of what's happening to lakes in the world. There are some global threats there. So we're seeing sort of worldwide that lakes that freeze over for part of the year, that ice duration formation is getting less. So we've got, you know, lakes will change in their inherent nature as global warming proceeds. The surface water of lakes are generally warming in some regions. They're warming more faster than others. That'll have implications on food webs, which may have implications for how humans utilize those lakes in terms of fish, for example. This is true not just of Siberia. This is true of, for example, the Great Lakes in tropical Africa, or it's true of, you know, high altitude lakes in South America, such as Lake Poopó or Lake Titicaca as well. Water extraction from lakes is really problematic. So I've also done a lot of work on the Aral Sea, which once was the fourth largest lake in the world, and now has lost over 90% of its volume due to abstraction of water for cotton irrigation. So now the Aral Sea is probably, you know, one of the world's true environmental catastrophes, because we took out so much water before it arrived in the lake. You know, the lake became hypersaline, it lost all its fish, it lost all its biodiversity. And we can trace that through chemical records, but we can also trace it through the diatoms as well. And that's, you know, we did some work on that about 10, 15 years ago. So there are kind of common problems. And another sort of common problem facing lakes is through fertilization from agriculture, through either what we call point source pollution, as we put more fertilizer on the land, it finds its way into the lakes, that causes nutrient enrichment, but also through atmospheric nitrogen as well. And we can use diatoms to show, and also stable isotopes of nitrogen. We can use that to show that even in remote regions such as the Arctic, they're being fertilized because of what we're doing in Europe and North America. That's having a huge impact, you know, in regions very remote to those industrial centers. So you know, there's lots of changes going on at the moment, and how, you know, global warming interacts with increasing nutrient enrichment. You know, these interacting stressors is obviously going to be very problematic in the future as well.
You probably have an amazing insight into all of the things going on wrong in this world and how humans are affecting these lacustrine systems. How messed up is the situation?
One of the things about lakes is that, so if you imagine a lake exists in the landscape, and for most lakes in the world, they're receiving most of the water, and their water coming through from rivers, and rivers are draining the catchments, they're draining the land. So every time we dump stuff onto the land into landfills, or we, you know, we farm the land, or we chop down trees, etc., all the changes in the land, all that waste, eventually some of it finds its way into lakes. And so I think it's just, you know, this notion of, you know, we need to try to reduce the pollution that we produce. Everything that we do as humanity finds its way into lakes and finds its way into lake sediments. So now, for example, you know, we're reconstructing microplastics in lake sediments. We're reconstructing what we call novel compounds, such as organic compounds from personal care products, estrogen. We can even record the derivatives of drugs in lake sediments. So, you know, and all these things have the potential to change fresh waters. And so I think kind of like the take-home message really should be, you know, if we don't take care of the you know, our landscape, our environment and the planet, lakes and lake sediments are really good at recording all the waste that we're producing. And that, you know, I remember seeing these things rising in the last kind of 50 years since the end of the Second World War. This process called the Anthropocene, humans rivaling geology as a force of nature, the great acceleration with the increase in, you know, GDP, our own consumption, etc., plastics, use of oil in the last 50 years. All those we can record in lake sediments. And that kind of really tells us, and because we can see this happening in lakes in the Arctic, in lakes at high altitude, in lakes in continental Siberia, we can see it in the Antarctic, we can see it in tropical systems. That's why I really think we, you know, to me is one of the bigger reasons why we need to sort of, you know, sort of clean up our act, basically, because we can see these increases happening in lake sediments, and it's very real. And so, you know, not only are we recording this, we're also seeing changes in the freshwater itself. So yeah, so I think sort of any sort of take-home message would be that we know we need to really maintain, you know, reduce pollution, maintain biodiversity, because ultimately it's going to affect, you know, what we can get from the planet ourselves. Don't mess it up is my key home take-home message, I think.
So if anyone is listening, thinking about being a paleontologist or studying environmental science, this whole episode, I think, gives the imperative to do that. But how would you sell your research to anyone thinking about doing something similar?
I think by looking at lakes and lake sediments and looking at the different kind of environmental proxies contained within them, you know, I work in a geography department, and one of the things that I like about geography is that we have people working who come from earth science backgrounds, from physics backgrounds, studying a climate. We have sociologists, we have people studying humanities, people who study how people use lakes, nature conservation, ecosystem services, all these kind of things. Chemists working in biogeochemical cycles. You know, no matter what you're interested in, whether you're coming from humanities or scientific background, you know, working on freshwater systems, you know, there are always questions that are important for understanding how humanity impacts the environment. I think that's incredibly important. And so anyone who has an interest in trying to understand how the planet is changing, whether it's in recent timescales linked to humanity, or whether it's on past timescales as to how, you know, the planet has evolved in terms of biodiversity, biogeochemical cycling, climate change, etc., then, you know, all these answers can be got from looking at different types of lakes and their lake sediment records. And that, to me, is absolutely fascinating. You know, there's something there for everyone, I would say.
And when you say there's something for everyone, who is everyone? Are they people like you and me? White male?
So very good question. A very good point to make. So it's undoubtedly true that I think paleontology has been dominated by particular groups of people. And as we look to questions, so, you know, I think when we're looking to questions of, say, the environment, these are questions which have an impact on society, and these are questions which impact on people. And if we are going to be continually excluding groups of people from undertaking sort of different types of research, then we're not going to be addressing how, you know, we're impacting the planet on this in the most holistic of terms, in the most inclusive in terms. I think that's why we're seeing in paleontology, in geography, in the earth sciences, in ecology, we're seeing a push for a push in two ways. One is a much more inclusivity as to who does the science. So, you know, we are underrepresented in terms of women doing much of the science. were very much underrepresented, especially in Europe and North America, for example, in terms of people who are coming from a Black, Asian, other minority ethnic background doing the science. We're still underrepresented with people who are LGBTQI+, for example, different sexual identities, different sexual gender identities as well. And if we're not including these people, then we're losing out in, you know, lots of, you know, different, you know, brain powers being used here. And, you know, if we're just focusing in a particular, you know, part of the population, then, you know, we will not be addressing the questions as seriously as we could be. And some of these questions are very pressing. And linked to that, we have, like, you know, many of the world's problems are facing people who are, you know, might be in our, you know, are less economically well off, for example, or they might be threatened through, you know, global warming is going to impact the poorest to the greatest extent. And so, you know, we need to take consideration of that as a discipline as well. And so there are many kind of avenues to improve, you know, what I would call, like, you know, looking at equity, looking at diversity, looking at inclusion in the subject of paleontology. And only by, you know, bringing everyone together and giving everyone the opportunity to learn about these things, and also to be able to take part in the science, then that's only really how we're going to truly tackle some of these global problems.
Okay. Is there anything else missed or that you'd want to discuss?
I would suppose, like, sort of to link to that kind of, like, sort of EDI perspective. So, you know, I'm a white male professor, and, you know, I'm from that. I've had lots of privileges in how I've sort of, you know, done my science. And I'm sure I've been given, you know, many opportunities because I'm a white man as well, but also I'm gay, and so, you know, come under the LGBTQI plus a banner as well. And within that, I've also experienced considerable amount of prejudice and homophobia in my discipline as well, including being directed at me personally, you know, during my PhD and during my postdoc as well. And I can see how, you know, that puts off many people, and so, you know, our own actions and discipline have a way of putting off women, of putting off LGBT people, of putting off people who are Black or Asian, and so if you know, I've experienced that personally. And so for other people who don't make it into academia or push out of science, then we're losing a lot of intellectual a strength and merit there. And that's a reason why these EDI principles are incredibly important. So I guess I'm kind of saying that from a personal perspective of being LGBT, but also, you know, one who has had a lot of privilege in my own academic upbringing as well. And so, you know, we need to recognize this all the time. And if we can start to do this, then I think we'll make science a much more inclusive and enjoyable discipline to work in.
Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me. Very, really interesting. Thank you.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall Smith. PaleoCast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the PaleoCast Gaming Network.